This is David Weiss for the Daily Worker Placement, and you're listening to The Game Changers, Season 2, Episode 1, Resetting the Pieces. Hello again. When I started The Game Changers, my structure was clear. I would use 12 games to tell the story of modern tabletop board games. And by doing so, argue that tabletop games are not just a hobby, but an art form. For the record, and just to recap, those games were Magic the Gathering, Catan, Ticket to Ride, Twilight Struggle, Agricola, Dominion, The Resistance, Cards Against Humanity, Love Letter, Gloomhaven, and Wingspan. If I could go back, I'd probably want to put Pandemic in there as the prototypical cooperative game and make it a baker's dozen, but other than that, I still think those games make pretty good signposts for tabletop's modern history. I brought Season 1 of the Game Changers to a close by saying, I'm proud of what I've put together over this past year, but I need some time away from the treadmill to just play and enjoy games without worrying about getting my ducks in a row for the next podcast. How long that break will be, I don't know. Well, that break turned out to be about 14 months. 14 months during which the COVID-19 pandemic continued to impose serious restrictions on our lives and livelihoods and, of course, our mental health and gaming habits. Days melted into days, then weeks, then months, one day very much like another, even as the weather slowly drifted from a relatively mild and snowless winter, by Toronto standards, into a brief spring, and then a torrid summer. In late summer, the situation had improved to the point where stores and FLGSs opened up again for face-to-face gaming here in Toronto, and for a couple of months there, things felt almost normal. And then the Omicron variant reminded us that viruses don't care about things like being done with COVID. Now, like many tabletop gamers in 2020 and 21, I migrated to online platforms such as Tabletop Simulator, Tabletopia, Board Game Arena, Vassal, and Yakeda, as well as proprietary apps for games like Twilight Struggle, It's a Wonderful World, and Seven Wonders. Each of these platforms has their pluses and minuses, and none are as good as playing in person, yet they're better than nothing, particularly when I've been able to use vocal chat on Discord or Facebook Messenger to have at least a tiny bit of real-time social connection. In particular, the digital port of Gloomhaven has seriously made me think twice about keeping my physical copy. I mean, when the computer can have things up and running again in a couple of minutes instead of half an hour, and you can save the game anytime, who needs a 10-pound box of stuff? I've even done some playtesting online for designers like Eric Lang and Peter Hayward, who've had to adapt to not being able to work on their projects in person. Digital prototyping also has pluses and minuses, which I'll talk about later this season. But to be honest, I've probably spent more time playing video games over the past 14 months than board games. Video games just take less cognitive load than board games. There's no setup and takedown time. It doesn't matter if your attention span is shot. You can save and come back to any number of games that much more easily. And of course, the computer takes care of all the fiddly bits. Replaying Fallout New Vegas, Skyrim, and Wolfenstein New Order has been like leaning back into a soft, warm, mind-numbing pile of goo. And a lot of the time, that's been what I wanted and needed. Out there in the wasteland, the tabletop industry has also had to adapt to COVID. On the one hand, many publishers saw sales increase as people were forced to make their own fun at home and were tired of looking at screens all day. On the other hand, manufacturing and transport were bottlenecked as factories were shut and transportation networks hobbled, especially since such a large share of tabletop games are now manufactured in China, the country which also happened to be the first to bear the brunt of the virus. And don't forget the ship that blocked the Suez Canal for an entire week in the March of 2021. 2021 also witnessed a series of, for the lack of a better term, incidents, in which the tabletop world also continued to grapple with and argue about the issues which I discussed in episode 13 of season 1, the one about Wingspan, namely representation, diversity, codes of conduct in the industry, and the degree to which political ideas and viewpoints could or should manifest in tabletop themes, whether intentionally or not. On a personal level, in October of 2020, I decided to move back in with my mother because she was facing the prospect of having to bubble all on her own, and I was worried about how she would manage on her own. That's turned out to be the one part of the COVID experience about which I feel no sadness or regret. I've been able to look after her after all she's done for me. Plus, I've been able to introduce her to some of the best games modern tabletop has to offer. We came full circle from her sharing her love of Rummy, Canasta, Boggle, and especially Scrabble with me when I was a child. At 82, my mom's enthusiasm for trying new games hadn't waned, but her ability to learn and hold on to new sets of rules had unfortunately declined, which of course is understandable, but sad to confront. Games that had too many rules or that required too much logical thinking or long-term planning were out, but that still left plenty of possibilities. The ones we played the most were the Timeline card games by Frédéric Henry, which was a great spur to my mom's memory, Speedy Words by Israeli design collective Trio Games, which also gave us both a good workout, Lost Cities to Go by the good doctor Rainer Knizia, which is a recent variant of his classic five-suited card game Lost Cities and hits the sweet spot between luck and strategy. And finally, there was Lucky Numbers, an elegant numbered tile sorting game designed by yet another veteran, Michael Schacht, known for his light and midweight classics Coloretto, Web of Power, and Hansa. Unfortunately, by late summer, my mom's attention span and cognition began to degrade further, and she stopped asking to play games, preferring to sit and watch Netflix all day. And then, in December of 2021, my mom took a turn for the worse and has been confined to bed ever since. It's been a lot more hands-on care and attention and a bit less time for my hobbies and interests, and yet, over the past 14 months, I've never stopped completely playing tabletop games, nor have I stopped thinking about them. In fact, one day last spring, I was digging through some stuff I'd stored in my mom's garage. Naturally, I was looking for something else, and there it was. Understanding Comics by Scott McCloud. I've mentioned this book in the final episode of Season 1 as the original inspiration for the Game Changers. The thing was, I actually hadn't read it in quite a while. I think it's time to look at this again, I said to myself, and I did. And it was still as great a book as I remembered. There were whole sections of the book that I'd forgotten about, and I started to think about whether and how much of the rest of Understanding Comics I could apply to tabletop. Rereading Understanding Comics has led me to formulate four fundamental questions about the art of tabletop. Question one, what is a game, and what are its essential building blocks? Question two, what basic types of game are there, and where do tabletop games fit in? Question three, why are tabletop games fun? What do we get out of them, and what, if anything, can designers and publishers do to maximize the fun potential of their games? And question four, are there any unexplored frontiers left in tabletop design? If not, why not? And if there are, where might they be? These four big questions formed the shimmery outline of The Game Changers Season 2. So let's dig in and ask the big question. What is a game? Mark Rosewater, who began working at Wizards of the Coast in 1995 and became head designer for Magic the Gathering in 2003, wrote a blog post in 2018 in which he defined a game as a thing with a goal or goals, restrictions, agency, and a lack of real-world relevance. He explains and justifies his definition by saying that Without goals, you have something totally open-ended, like a toy. Without restrictions, which he defines as obstacles, and I don't know why he didn't just say that, because it muddies the water a bit, but without restrictions, you're just doing something, which is an activity. Without agency, you're a passive observer, like at an event. And something with real life consequences is just that, real life. So take a minute, pause the playback or rewind, and roll that definition around in your head to see if it makes sense to you. A game is a thing with a goal or goals, restrictions, agency, and a lack of real world relevance. Now, for me, I don't think it's a bad definition, but I think there's a problem. He himself poked a hole in it when he brought up the examples of Candyland and Tic-Tac-Toe. In the first case, players lack agency because their progress is completely subject to the whims of the cards that determine your movement. In the second case, Tic-Tac-Toe, we have a game that has been solved mathematically. There's a perfect strategy, and as long as both players play optimally, they really have no choice. Outcomes are foreseen after a set number of moves. Rosewater tries to skirt the issue by saying that Candyland and Tic-Tac-Toe are still games, but only for new players who haven't figured them out yet, or for children who don't understand determinism. But for the rest of us, they're not games. Now, I'm certainly not going to argue that Candyland and Tic-Tac-Toe are good or interesting, but Rosewater's solution to dismiss them from the games category entirely is, I think, mistaken. There's a missed opportunity here to think about the role that all games, even totally solved or luck-based ones, play in our lives. So instead of dismissing or demoting Tic-Tac-Toe, Candyland, and their nibblings with a new label, the way Pluto was redefined as a dwarf planet in August 2006 by the International Astronomical Union, I'm going to suggest a definition of games that I think streamlines and improves on Rosewater's. It's come from thinking about how games, whether they're tabletop or digital, differ from other art forms. Let's start by thinking about all the types of creative expression that we have. Painting, sculpture, music, drama, film, literature, graphic novels, architecture, design, fashion, cuisine, and I'm sure you can think of more. We can categorize them in different ways. We can categorize them by which senses they engage, or by how active or passive they require their participants to be, or how and in what ways they meet human needs. But one thing all art has in common, I believe, is that it satisfies the basic human need to tell and hear stories. Those stories are not all long-form narratives. Some explore one situation or person deeply, like portraiture or landscape art. Or they may be flashes of an experience shared, like haikus. Or they may be cathartic or humorous nano-stories, like political cartoons or TikTok videos, which are over practically before they've begun, and yet have the power to embed and propagate in our collective consciousness. An April 2020 story on NPR collects together some of the recent research on why and how our brains respond to stories, and what consequences that has for our development. We are just beginning to understand how we human beings are hardwired to learn through narrative. So where do games fit in? Well, games are primarily a visual and auditory medium, although there is a tiny, tiny subset that have tried to use smell, believe it or not. That's something to revisit later. They're definitely participatory. I mean, watching people play a game is a form of entertainment, but to consume a game, you have to play it. So we're left with the narrative piece. If games are an art form, they provide a narrative. So where's the narrative in a game? Now, I'm not a hardline Darwinian survival of the fittest biological determinist. We're only just beginning to learn about the role that altruism and cooperation plays in evolution. But there's no denying that we get a rush when we win something. Of course, some of us are better at dealing with our competitive impulses than others. So what separates games from other cultural artifacts, the one thing games have that other art forms don't, is winners and losers. And you can't have winners and losers without some kind of conflict, even in cooperative games, where you beat or are beaten by the game. And as any writer will tell you, conflict is the necessary engine that drives plot, which leads directly to my definition of what makes a game. A game is a machine for telling stories that end with someone winning and or losing. I'll say it again. A game is a machine for telling stories that end with someone winning and or losing. Now, you might say to yourself, tic-tac-toe doesn't tell a story. And I would answer, it's a very short one, and it's not very interesting, but it does. It has a beginning, a very brief middle, and ends about a minute later in a tie, if both players play optimally. So it's extremely predictable and boring. But it is a story. It's the game equivalent to the first generation of moving pictures, which were 30-second moviolas that cost a nickel and you watch standing up peering down into a machine showing a train coming into a station, or two people kissing, or a horse galloping. No one thought movies were an art form until pioneers like Georges Méliès and Edwin Porter came along, who saw the potential for movies to tell real stories. Think about games like chess and Go. Classic abstracts with at most a nano-thin veneer of theme. They both have beginnings, middles, and ends that emerge from gameplay and strategy alone, with no need for flavor text or motivating backstory. Think of Contract Bridge, with its two-act structure of bidding and then playing out the bid, and the suspense of seeing whether the contract will succeed or not. Each section of chess and Go and both faces of bridge have spawned separate but connected industries of strategy books. Now, some of you, like my cousin, when I first shared my definition of what a game is, might ask, well, what about puzzles? Your definition seems to imply that things like Sudoku and jigsaws are solitaire games. And for a few minutes, I thought he had me. In my experience, doing jigsaws or solving well-constructed Sudoku or themed crosswords can feel like a narrative experience with a beginning, middle, and end. With jigsaws, for instance, first you work on the corners and the borders, and then you work on the colorful bits of the middle, and then you finish by filling in the boring bits of the background. And with Sudoku, particularly killer and other varieties Sudoku, there is an initial phase where you just sit there and think and stare at the grid and work out the logic before you fill in even a single cell. And then you chip away and you chip away until all that's left are the final few cells which you fill by elimination. And solving a puzzle does feel like winning a game, in my experience. Ah. But then I realized that the difference between a puzzle and a game is that a puzzle is meant to be solved, at least a fair one is. The puzzle setter might make it fiendishly difficult, but she ultimately wants you to solve it. Throwing down the puzzle in disgust and walking away might be seen as a loss, but that's generally considered to reflect badly on the constructor, not on the solver. Game designers and the players who play their games enter into a social contract of sorts, where the players understand they might lose, but for all but the most competitive players, the experience of the game is the point. Hence, puzzles might be thought of as game adjacent, but they're not games. So now, let me tell you whose phrasing I borrowed from for my definition of what a game is. A Swiss-French architect named Charles-Édouard Jeanneret, better known as Le Corbusier, or Corbeau, to architect nerds. Corbeau was born in Neuchâtel in 1887 and studied applied arts and painting, but under the influence of his teacher Le Platinier, he drifted into design and architecture. though he never had formal training in it. Like his contemporary Frank Lloyd Wright, Kolb's early career was marked by a passion for building affordable housing for working people, using modern construction materials and techniques. By World War I, he was back at his old school teaching theoretical architecture. But after the war, he moved to Paris and plunged back into the art scene, founding the Purist School, which rejected Cubism, and, starting a magazine called L'Esprit Nouveau, he espoused his views on architecture. In 1923, he published a collection of his essays in a book called Vers une architecture, Toward an Architecture, which eventually became the manifesto for generations of architects and city planners, for better and for worse. His own buildings were so influential that 17 of them, spread over 7 countries, were collectively added to UNESCO's World Heritage List in 2016. Toward an Architecture contained Corbusier's most quoted and ridiculed statement, "Une maison est une machine à habiter." A house is a machine for living in. It encapsulated his belief in function over form, engineering-based design, and it led directly to my own definition of what a game is, which I'll repeat again because I can. A game is a machine for telling stories that end with someone winning and or losing. Now, the next step is to differentiate tabletop games from all the other types, of which there are a few. The most obvious way to draw a boundary is that tabletop games have physical components and are almost always played sitting around a common area, which is usually a table, but could also be a floor or a picnic blanket if the players are outside, for instance. This definition thus gathers into itself the traditional categories which distinguish games by their main components: board games, card games, and dice games, as well as the relatively newer category of role-playing games. And each genre has its own set of required components. So although people often think of board games, dice games, card games, and RPGs as completely different entities, I'll be arguing these distinctions are relatively superficial. They all share the same design process and range of player experiences. My definition of tabletop games also separates them from games requiring athleticism, which are often called sports, but also includes games like Tag or British Bulldog or Capture the Flag, which I'll call recess or camp games because that's when they're generally played, at recess or at camp, as well as games played without specialized equipment indoors in social settings like charades or broken telephone. These used to be called parlor games, and I traced their history in season 1. Their present-day commercial descendants use proprietary components and span everything from Time's Up and Cards Against Humanity to the Resistance and Codenames, and comfortably inhabit the party game genre within tabletop itself. So, now that we have a workable definition of tabletop games and have differentiated them from other types of games, we can start to think about their atomic structure. What are the basic building blocks that, when assembled, make up a game? That will be the subject of episode 2. Meanwhile, I'm curious to hear your thoughts about my definition of what a game is. If you agree, that's great. And if you think it sucks, tell me why. I look forward to your emails. This is David Weiss for the Daily Worker Placement. Thanks for listening. See you next time. And don't flip that table.